From the Moon Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. The state legislature's deadlocked over how to respond to California's massive wildfires. A 72-page draft bill deals with how much financial responsibility falls on power companies. Nutrient brush removal rules also under debate. How should the state respond to historically large fires? We'll dive in after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCalGas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a good day. Always a pleasure to have you with us. Whether you found our KPCC app is the best way for you to tune in on your phone or other device, whether it's going to kpcc.org for the stream or listening on terrestrial radio. Glad to have you with us. Coming up, car makers scrambling to adapt to big changes that are quickly overtaking their industry. But it's not the changes that we widely expected a few years ago. The big trend in car buying later this hour. First, the state legislature's at odds over a massive bill written in response to California's historically large wildfires. At issue, how much financial responsibility should fall on utility companies to pay for wildfire damage and firefighting costs if downed lines were one of the reasons the fire started? Also, how far should the state go in mandating brush and tree removal in high fire areas? With us is Los Angeles Times Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers. John, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Larry.
So your report came from late last night. So they're still trying to work their way through this conference of the two houses?
Yeah, they are. And they're facing a super tight deadline on this. Today, Tuesday, is the deadline for bill language to be submitted to be voted on before the legislature adjourns on Friday night. So whatever's going to be in this proposal has to be in print, available to the public by late tonight, and that's a matter of hours here. And this is a really, really complicated topic. I mean, in some ways, for listeners, it's not. We're talking about how to prevent future wildfires, who should pay for them, how do we clear fire-prone trees and brush. But the details matter, and as you said, not the least of which is the role of a utility company if their equipment is found to be part of this, as well as, of course, environmental considerations about removing that kind of trees and brush.
Well, and so let's talk about the liability issue. Is this bill designed to in some way lessen the responsibility of the utility companies to pay for the effects of fires?
It's certainly designed, whatever comes out of this, Larry, to mitigate, I think, the cost to the utilities. You've had one of the major investor-owned utilities, PG&E, already come out and say, look, we're in real financial straits if we have to pay what we owe from the 2017 fires. They've already put a number of about $2.5 billion in damages. People will remember mainly those fires in Wine Country, Napa, and Sonoma counties that state investigators have said their equipment played a role in. So they want a solution to 2017, and they want changes moving forward. The shorthand for listeners here is that the current system basically says if a utility company's equipment is involved in a fire, that utility company can be responsible for all the damages, even if they did everything right, even if a tree fell into the lines. Utility companies want another look at that. They say, we're going to go bankrupt. We can't do this in this new era of fire-prone California. The governor has agreed. There are other stakeholders that agree, but there's a massive pushback now from business groups and consumer groups that say this can't be passed on to ratepayers. This has got to be borne by the shareholders of the company or others. Ratepayers shouldn't be footing this bill.
Well, and so what's the potential if, let's say, PG&E files for bankruptcy? Obviously, that's bad news for the investors, but are there concerns that the company might not have the ability to keep up the infrastructure?
I think there are a couple of concerns. First of all, it depends on who you talk to about the severity to the average consumer. I mean, no one No one is talking about a company like PG&E or, for that matter, Edison or San Diego Gas and Electric, you know, turning off the power. But it does come down to the kinds of things that those companies can invest in. And really, really key to this is that these big investor-owned utilities have agreed to invest in things that will further California's climate change goals, the kinds of energy that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And there are people warning that if the companies don't have money, they can't continue on that path forward, which is a big policy goal of California. And so we're at this point, at this 11th hour here in Sacramento, Larry, where we really are between a rock and a hard place for these politicians and these policy groups about helping the utilities, but how much to help the utilities. And the word that every politician in this town wants to avoid is the word bailout. No one wants to be seen as bailing out these utilities and their shareholders.
So the language in the bill has to be set by today, and that's to meet the public posting of that for comment before it's voted on by the end of the month deadline?
That's correct. The legislature adjourns by law on Friday night, August 31st, and voters in 2016 in the state approved a change to the state constitution that says all legislation has to be available for the public to read it 72 hours before a final vote. You do the math, and Tuesday night, tonight, is the night that something has got to happen. They have a bill in print. They talked about it last night, but I watched that committee hearing, and I think there are serious differences among these lawmakers about how to move forward. And we should point out, Larry, it's not all about the utilities. There are questions about vegetation management and who pays for that and how much to pay for that, and a discussion whether the money should come out of California's climate change fund, the cap-and-trade money that has been paid in by companies. There are serious questions beyond the utilities, but the utilities thing really is a white-hot part of this debate.
And, John, the clearing of trees and brush, is this on public lands, or is this a mandate for private landholders that they would have to do more to clear their properties? What does this specifically look at?
Well, I mean, I think the best way to think about it is there are a couple of parts that lawmakers are looking at. First of all, they're looking at ways to kind of streamline the process. One of the criticisms has been that the regulatory process of being able to remove particular trees or particular brush is burdensome, and that it takes too long, and that there are conflicting environmental reports depending on where you're doing this. The other part, of course, is trying to provide incentives for some private landowners to get in there and do their part at thinning the kind of vegetation that could start fires. And that's where you get into these ideas of grants or financial incentives to make it worth their time. There's also a discussion about whether people who have trees on their property could sell that for lumber and basically, you know, somehow get some money back to going into cutting things down. All of that has to be reworked in state law. All of that is complicated, and that is that's a key element to this. You feel watching these negotiations, Larry, as though you could find some middle ground on that. That might, if it wasn't for the utilities part, be moving forward. But again, this is such a complicated topic. This is a 72-page bill that was made public last night, a draft of it. And everybody kept saying that old adage, the devil's in the details. It really is.
We're talking with John Myers, Los Angeles Times, Sacramento Bureau Chief, talking about this huge bill that has a practical deadline of today that it needs to be written. And it deals with multiple aspects of California's historically large wildfires, liability, efforts to try and thin brush and trees to avoid these kind of large-scale fires. And, of course, as we've seen over the past 2-3 years throughout California, historically large fires that have thrown off a tremendous amount of smoke. And, John, I assume that's the justification supporters of using greenhouse gas cap-and-trade revenues. They see it, if the fires can be controlled, then that helps cut down on the effect on the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are lawmakers who I have talked to over the last couple of weeks who will say, you know, look, measure all of the greenhouse gas effect of all of those fires, of all of that smoke, of the warming nature of that. Measure that against what we have reduced over recent time by cutting emissions of industries and things like that. And they are, it's a mismatch that these fires are putting out a lot of stuff into the atmosphere that we have to take in consideration. And they think that's why we should be using this money. It does seem to me that a lot of this is not so much whether to use the money, but how much of the money to use. The estimates range from a couple of $100 million a year to $300 million a year. And there are other projects that people want out of that cap and trade cash, that money that businesses have been paying for these kind of pollution credits. So money always kind of comes back to this. But this is a pretty complicated topic. And of course, we would be remiss in not pointing out that all of this is playing out with the backdrop of these devastating fires of 2018. The fires that we have seen have not had a nexus to electrical utilities this year as compared to last year's fires. But just the simple fact that smoke has been hanging over the state capital, the capital city of Sacramento, as these lawmakers have come in, is a real reminder that people are worried and they want to see what the, you know, what the future is going to look like to deal with these fires.
Well, and it's such a big issue. John, yesterday we had Senator Dianne Feinstein on the program to talk about the death of John McCain. And one of the points unsolicited that she made is that, you know, California's got to figure out how to respond to these massive fires. So even in D.C., I mean, it's an issue that people are paying attention to back here. John, I appreciate it as always. Thanks so much. I know you're extremely busy as we await the deadline for the passage or shelving of all these bills that are coming. I'm sure we'll be talking with you in the coming days. Thanks.
You're welcome. As always, stay tuned.
Thanks. Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times, John Myers, joining us this morning on Air Talk. I was reading the Wall Street Journal over the weekend and came across a really excellent article by Mike Colias, who reports on the auto industry for the Journal. He really laid out dramatic changes that are taking place in the car buying field and how manufacturers are scrambling to try and respond to these trends. And the trends are very different than what we expected to see just a couple of years ago. Mike Colias, thank you for being with us.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
So we had thought, you know, as recently 2-3 years ago, we would be seeing a dramatic increase in the sales of all-electric sedans, that would be the move, that the hybrid market would continue to expand dramatically, largely through sedans. But we're seeing something rather different here, brought about by comparatively low gas prices. Share with us the trend.
Yeah, I mean, the electrics and the hybrids, they are growing, but it's off such a small base that it barely makes a blip, at least as far as the auto industry is concerned. You're right about the gas prices, and I think that's one factor that's playing into this huge trend that we're seeing toward sport utility vehicles and away from passenger cars, most notably sedans, which, you know, for decades have been sort of the body shape of choice. I mean, it's just kind of the shape of the automobile that, you know, from little kids first learning to scrawl pictures, drawing a shape of the sedan. I mean, it's just kind of what people think of as vehicles. And the market has really, just in the last few years, flipped in a dramatic way toward SUVs.
And how much of that is that SUVs themselves are much more fuel efficient than the past, making them more attractive to people who might have been on the fence about having a larger vehicle?
That's definitely a big part of it. So this, you know, this trend isn't new. I mean, this has been playing out for 20 years, and the first SUVs really go back, you know, in the 1930s. Chevrolet made a Suburban, which they still make today. So I mean, these vehicles have been in the market for a long time. I think what's been so striking in the last couple of years, in new car sales, less than 5 years ago, it was split 50-50 between passenger cars, which is mostly sedans, and then on the other side, trucks, which we lump in SUVs, pickups, and vans. And now that's flipped to 70-30 trucks to sedans. And so, you know, I think what's going on here, it's a bit of a chicken and egg. Yes, people are gravitating toward SUVs, but that's partly because the auto industry's figured out a way to sort of offer the best attributes of an SUV in a more usable, efficient package. So that does give you much better gas mileage than you may have gotten in one of the trucky bouncy SUVs from the 90s for sure. Still not as good as a comparable car, but far better gas mileage. And then you get all the other stuff that people like about it, which is a higher ride height, so it's easier to get in and out of. People like that sort of more commanding view of the road. You get more space both in the front seat and the back space, in the back seat. You definitely get more cargo space. You get all-wheel drive is a lot easier to put in. So they figured out a way to package all this stuff in a car that's more affordable and a lot better gas mileage than the sort of bigger SUVs that we used to think of.
And there's also a change in aesthetics versus utility, that equation. We're going to talk with our next guest about that as we continue. He's historian at the University of Dayton in Ohio. He focuses on the history of the automobile as well as science and technology. We'll talk with John Heitman and continue with Wall Street Journal's Mike Colias. He covers the automotive industry, wrote a terrific piece which not only looks at current trends in what car buyers are looking for and how manufacturers are trying to get on top of those changes, but also the history of the automobile's evolution and what consumers have sought. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute. I welcome your questions, thoughts about the changing automotive industry, what car buyers want, how manufacturers are dealing with that. We just heard from the Wall Street Journal's Mike Colias that there are so many things that automakers can do with SUVs, crossover SUVs, bringing the sedan experience to the larger, more storage capacity vehicle. Also, the profit margins are better for those types of vehicles, better incentive for the industry to make those vehicles. But over time, we've seen changes in what car buyers want. One of the interesting comments in Mike's piece in the Wall Street Journal came from a historian, John Wokanowicz, who wrote all about activity today rather than elegance or performance. SUVs are made for dogs and kids and activities and taking care of the house. It's the tool that does the job. I'd like to hear from you if you think that's true, that cars have become more utilitarian, that it's not about what looks cool so much, the aesthetics of the vehicle, the sleek lines, the beauty of the car, or even the fun experience of driving it. The car has become a tool for most Americans. 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Speaking of the history of the automobile, we're very pleased to have with us from the University of Dayton in Ohio, Professor of History John Heitman. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Hello.
Hi. So one of the things I found interesting in Mike's piece was it pointed out that early American mass-produced cars almost looked more like an SUV than the sedan.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, maybe the most utilitarian car ever made in the United States was the Model T. High off the ground, very flexible. Farmers used it to do all kinds of tasks on the land, including adapting saws and all kinds of tools to get the job done. So in some ways, you could say the real first SUV, although it wasn't an SUV, was the Model T.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And then when GM starts introducing these more elegant, streamlined, longer, lower to the ground vehicles, how long did it take for that look to kick in?
You know, I think it begins in the 1970s, even though with the 1970s, you see those oil shocks, 1 and 2 in 73 and 79. But certainly by the 1980s, what we're beginning to see is, things like Home Depot, Lowe's. People begin to think of pickup trucks and SUVs. And I think Americans are also getting bigger. We have a pretty high obesity rate, but Americans have always been a big people in a way. And these SUVs fit not just lifestyle, but lives themselves. And so by the early 1980s, you see the SUV beginning its steady ascent. And I think curiously with it, what you see is the concurrent decline of what we used to think of an SUV of sorts, and that was the station wagon.
Yeah, and I was actually going back, though, to Harley Earl, and as talking about the when people went from the more utilitarian concept to the concept of the elegant, beautiful vehicle with, yes. with Harley Earl's design. And did that help to push the car as the status symbol for middle-class people?
You know, I mean, that was Harley Earl, longer and lower. Beginning in the 1920s, slowly with the LaSalle, a companion car to the Cadillac. But it was also echoed in the words of Charles Kettering, keeping the customer dissatisfied. And yes, I mean, the automobile becomes quite a status symbol, although you can go back to the beginning of automotive history in this country and those first 15 years or so when the automobile was more of a plaything for the rich than something for the middling classes. It was the ultimate freedom machine, and it said a lot about who you are and what you do and your ambitions and what you thought of yourselves and others.
We're talking with automotive historian from the University of Dayton, John Heitman, Mike Colias, Wall Street Journal reporter who covers the automotive industry. We have a link to the piece that he wrote for the journal on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Joaquin in South L.A. says unibody SUVs are little more than station wagons and minivans. How much has the rise of SUVs come from cannibalizing wagons and van sales? Mike Colias, your thoughts on that?
Well, he's right, and you hear this a lot. People who are real car enthusiasts will sort of scoff and say that, you know, these crossovers are really just tall cars. And in a way, they're right. But the dramatic shift we've seen in that toward that body style, I think, says something about the fact that the sedan, which has long been the sort of predominant, you know, passenger car style, wasn't giving people enough utility. And so I think, you know, minivans have always, they've kind of held steady over the years since the big boom in the 80s. They're a nice little market, and you still got some manufacturers that play in that space, and they really work well for, you know, people with larger families. But these crossover SUVs, which he's right, unibody is sort of a engineering term that's thrown around in the industry. But what that means is it's no longer based on a truck platform. So it's, you know, it's essentially a car. I mean, it doesn't take the industry much to make a crossover SUV out of a car platform. So think of a Honda Civic. It doesn't take a whole lot to make a Honda Civic into a Honda CRV, you know, maybe $1,000 in extra material, but then people are willing to pay $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 more. So, I mean, the industry's really hit on something here, and people are embracing the concept even more so than I think the industry realized, which is why you've seen a lot of what's gone on in the last few years, which is, you know, GM having to lay off a few thousand people at its passenger car plants because they're making sedans that not as many people want anymore.
Charles driving on the San Diego freeway through the Sepulveda Pass. Charles, you wanted to talk about the crossover SUV.
Larry, I like to call it the Goldilocks car. I drive one myself. It's not too big, it's not too small, and it fits in with the sort of lifestyle we have now where there's a lot more leisure time blended in with work time so that you can drive from work to some skiing or to maybe a softball game, and there's room for all your equipment. So I drive a which is between the sort of bigger RX and the smaller CT.
Charles, you dropped out. What did you say you drive?
I drive an NX, a Lexus NX.
Yeah, an NX, okay.
RX and the CT. So I call it a Goldilocks. it's not too big, it's not too small, it's not too sporty, but it's not too clunky. And it fits this blended lifestyle with work and pleasure. You know, you can stick your football equipment in the back and drive from work. So
and you've got that smooth Lexus ride, even with the crossover. Charles, I really appreciate the call. Mike Elias, that's a great point he makes about the commingling of work and leisure, and that the utility, whether it can take stuff to go to the mountains on a ski trip or handle stuff you need to take to a job you're working on, that's a big deal.
Yeah, and it gets back to the point John Wolkanowicz in the article mentions, which is, you know, it's just people are more active than ever. And so, you know, youth sports as an example. I mean, outdoor sports is huge, too. More people than ever are doing things like rock climbing and skiing. Youth sports, you know, if you need to throw a bunch of baseball gear in the back of the car, a trunk doesn't always do the job. And the caller's right about one point, which is the reason why this has been such a big boom is that these crossover SUVs, they've gotten smaller and smaller to the point now where there's this subcompact category, which it's like a Buick Encore or a Mazda CX-3 or Honda HR-V. I mean, all of these, there's a dozen brand new nameplates that have come out just in the last 5 years. And these things are based off the smallest cars that the car makers make. And yet people are embracing them because you're sitting up high, it's more comfortable, it's easier to get in and out of. You know, it's providing this sort of niche that people never really had before.
Well, and it's kind of blurred the line between a hatchback and a compact SUV, right?
For sure, yeah. And then there are a lot of car people in the know will say, you know, these are all just hatchbacks. I mean, the thing is, they're a little longer than most hatchbacks used to be.
A little taller, maybe.
Our industry never really, at least in the U.S., I mean, hatchbacks are ubiquitous in Europe, as are wagons. And to the point of your previous caller, most car people love station wagons because they are more utilitarian, but the ride and handling of them, because they're low to the ground, you still get decent ride and handling. And so if you talk to most car buffs, we'll tell you that they have a love of the station wagon. Unfortunately, in the U.S., there's not a whole lot to choose from. If you want a big choice of wagons, you got to go to Europe.
Yeah, good point. Mike in La Crescenta, your thoughts on the trends in car buying?
Well, you know, I think we have an old Mercury Mariner. It's about 8 years old now, and it is nothing sexy about this thing. But we put the surfboards on it with the grandkids, and we've had the Boy Scouts up and down the state of California in it, and we use it for garden supplies. It kind of reminds you that your sexy days are gone, but damn, this thing is fun, and it was cheap, and we've got over a couple hundred thousand miles on it. So we've got a couple other cars if we're trying to impress someone that we'll drive, but this thing's the handiest.
Mike, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Yeah, it does seem when you look at the luxury car market, and I realize that all of them, you know, Mercedes, BMW, Audi, they all have their SUVs at various sizes. But it still seems to me, Mike Elias, that in affluent areas, that there still is a huge demand for the sedan for those who are looking for something that, you know, gives them the performance and the aesthetics they want.
Yeah, for sure. And that was one of the things when we were working on the article that we wanted to make sure was clear, is, and I think it's stated plainly in there, that the sedan is not dead. You know, just in the mainstream market, the, you know, more affordable sedans, like a Camry, let's say, or an Accord or a Ford Fusion, I mean, those remain options. Increasingly, if you talk to dealers, it's more for people who are just trying to get into a car, maybe.
You there?
There. A little more conscious of the payment. But luxury sedans are always going to be around, and there's always going to be a big market for those.
Yeah, it sure seems like it. Let's talk next with Ken in Hollywood. Ken, quick comment, please.
Yeah, I'm a real big fan of the crossover vehicle, exactly for the reasons as mentioned before. It gives me and my wife a little bit more space to go on camping adventures, but still has that kind of that tight platform of a sedan. And is a little bit further off the ground. So if we're, you know, sometimes we go on dirt roads, it's, I don't need a big old hulking behemoth of an SUV like from the 2000s. And so she and I, we both have Kia Souls, so she's my soulmate.
Oh.
We love these cars.
Oh.
It's perfect.
Ken, thank you. I'll close on that. Okay, Ken in Hollywood, and making the point, like our earlier caller said, it's sort of the Goldilocks vehicle. Thanks. Rick in Oak Park says, I know so many people, as soon as they have their first child, they got to get that bigger car. Car seats, much harder to put into small sedans. Boy, is that true, Rick. When we had our son years ago, trying to get those car seats into the back of the small sedan, do that without crippling yourself. Appreciate your call. My thanks to Mike Colias, Wall Street Journal reporter, wrote an excellent piece on the automotive industry and its evolution. John Heitman, historian at the University of Dayton, where he studies the history of the automobile, among other topics in technology and manufacturing. Stay tuned. We're going to look back at the creative output of playwright, screenwriter Neil Simon after a live update from Hedy Lyn Hurdy's. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon had an extraordinary four-decade run. He debuted on Broadway with Come Blow Your Horn in 1961, his last opening on The Great White Way, 45 Seconds from Broadway, in 2001. In between, his plays often held down multiple Broadway theaters simultaneously. In fact, 1966, he had four on stage at once: Barefoot in the Park, Sweet Charity, The Star-Spangled Girl, and The Odd Couple. Simon adapted The Odd Couple to film. It starred Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau as divorced friends who find out how hard it is to coexist in their shared Manhattan apartment.
The irony is that unless we come to some other arrangement, I'm going to kill you. That's the irony of it.
What's wrong, Oscar?
Something wrong with this system. That's what's wrong. I don't think that two single men living alone in a big eight-room apartment should have a cleaner house than my mother.
Well, what are you talking about? I didn't say that you have to do it. You don't have to clean up.
Well, what you do is worse. You're always in my bathroom hanging up my towels. Whenever I smoke, you follow me around with an ashtray. Last night, I found you in the kitchen washing the floor, shaking your head and moaning, footprints, footprints.
I didn't say they were yours.
Well, they were mine, damn it. I have feet and they make prints. What do you want me to do, climb across the cabinet?
Simon also wrote original screenplays like 1977's The Goodbye Girl, starring Simon's then-wife Marcia Mason, and Richard Dreyfuss in an Oscar-winning performance as a New York City stage actor subletting an apartment he discovers also houses a single mother and young daughter.
I'm not crazy about the arrangements.
You're not.
Definitely not. I'm paying the rent. I will make it a rules. I like to take showers every morning, and I don't like the panties drying on the rod. I like to cook, so I will use the kitchen whenever I damn well please. And I am very particular about my condiments, so keep your salt and pepper to yourself. Plus, I play the guitar in the middle of the night whenever I cannot sleep, and I meditate every morning, complete with chanting and burning incense, so if you've got to walk around, I'd appreciate a little tiptoeing. Also, I sleep in the nude. A buffo. Winter and summer, rain or snow, with the windows open. And because I may have to go to the potty or to the fridge in the middle of the night, and because I don't want to put on jammies, which I do not own in the first place, unless you're looking for a quick thrill or your daughter in advanced education, I would keep my door closed. Them's my rules and regulations. How does that grab you?
Richard Dreyfuss winning the Oscar for that performance. I actually called him at home Sunday, just a few hours after I'd heard about Neil Simon's passing, and understandably, he didn't feel in a position to go on air and to talk about it, but offered his condolences to Simon's family members. And obviously, a remarkable array of talent worked with Simon on stage and in the films that he wrote over the years. I want to open up the phone lines. If you worked with Neil Simon, if you're someone who acted on Broadway in one of his productions, if you were in one of his films with his screenplay, I'd like to hear about your experience. We're at 866-893-KPCC. What's that like to be reading the words written by Neil Simon, arguably the greatest commercial playwright that we've had? 866-893-KPCC. KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. With us, former senior drama critic for The New Yorker from 1992 to 2013, John Lahr. Mr. Lahr, it's good to have you with us again on AirTalk.
Hi.
So I mentioned that he's commercially unsurpassed, but for critics, his work was a much tougher sell until later in his career. Your thoughts about the craft of Simon's work?
Well, Simon's ability, the crucial aspect of Simon's work is almost mathematical. He in the early 60s, got to remember what the level of television was then in certain in comedy. Of course, he earned his spurs writing for Sid Caesar and Phil Silvers. And kept really great comic company with Carl Reiner, Woody Allen, Mel Brooks in the
Larry Gelbart. Yeah.
So he wrote jokes, but his gift was writing character and structuring plays around not situations, which is what television does, but around dilemmas, which is what theater does. And even in the clip that you played from The Odd Couple, you could hear that he has divided the characters. One is fastidious, and one is a slob. And that the argument between them is sort of factored out almost mathematically in a very sharp and witty. And yeah, in that particular case, I think it's a masterpiece of American comedy, which will absolutely endure. But the level of craft in the plays was never in doubt. The issue, and I think one of the reasons why he did find critical favor. I mean, you can't in his peak period between 61 and sort of the early 80s. There were 9,000 productions around 9,000 of his play.
Incredible.
He had a run. He wasn't arguably, as you said, the most commercial playwright. He was the most commercial playwright of the 20th century. He wrote over 30 plays. After Barefoot in the Park. He owned his plays in the sense that he didn't have producers. He produced his own plays. So that all the royalties came to him. He owned a theater on Broadway, the Eugene O'Neill. And after he sold that, he had there is a Neil Simon Theater on Broadway. He dominated the commercial world in a way that no other American comic playwright or playwright really has ever done in America. So he certainly could please. And I think one of the dilemmas I knew him to a degree, and he felt not honored in his time, although he was extremely rich and also. Very popular, but there is a confusion in a Puritan culture, which America is, between laughter and pleasure and seriousness, as if one cancels out the other. And if you give pleasure and create joy, which is what his business was, you aren't considered an artist, or as Mel Brooks famously said of Simon, he wasn't allowed into serious land.
Well, and it's a very similar thing to what we see in the Oscars, how difficult it is for a comedy to win Best Picture. It's almost unimaginable to think of comedy being held on that level of serious drama. We're talking with John Lahr, former senior drama critic for The New Yorker from 1992 to 2013, noted author as well. Let me take a call here before I join our next guest, Dave in Manhattan Beach. Dave, I understand you write sitcoms?
Yeah, I'm a longtime sitcom writer, and every good sitcom stands on the shoulders of Neil Simon. These are basically 21-minute plays that we write, multi-camera sitcoms are plays, one-act, two-act plays. And he's the one who invented the idea of being funny about being real, and who found the funny in the sadness, and who found the depth in the farcical. And we're just imitating him.
Wow. Dave, which shows have you written for?
Oh, let's leave that out of it.
Okay.
My agent to call.
Okay. All right, Dave. Dave in Manhattan Beach, talking about the lineage of sitcom writing, the importance of Neil Simon. Coming up from Deadline, chief film critic Pete Hammond. We'll talk with him about Neil Simon's plays as well as his screenplays, because he also wrote original work for the screen as well. Again, if you have worked with Neil Simon, you've performed his work on stage or in film or television, of course, The Odd Couple, a long-running, highly successful ABC television program. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Back with more on the legacy of Neil Simon in 1 minute. I only met Neil Simon once when I interviewed him for a memoir he wrote about 20 years ago. So he was in his early 70s at the time, and spent about an hour in his company. Very interesting, analytical person about his work. But like so many people that are funny and prolifically funny, Simon himself, just a very serious, very straightforward kind of man. Not uncommon, again, for those who work in comedy. We're talking about the legacy of Neil Simon, who died Sunday at the age of 91. Pete Hammond with us from Deadline, chief film critic and award columnist. Pete, thank you for joining us. Great to talk with you.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Your thoughts about, let me start with Simon on in film, because you know we think of him as a playwright so much, but he had like The Goodbye Girl, original screenplays too. Your thoughts about how the work translated to the screen?
Most of his screen work were adaptations of his plays, and I thought really in the beginning he really hit it out of the box when he started adapting his own screenplays. You know, his first play, Come Blow Your Horn, was the first one adapted for the screen, but it was done by Norman Lear, the screenplay, and he wasn't happy with that movie, and so he took it upon himself to write his own screenplays after that, and I think he wrote about 25 of them, but most of them adaptations. And I thought Barefoot in the Park was a terrific movie with Jane Fonda and Robert Redford. The Odd Couple is on every list of the 100 greatest film comedies of all time. He really did well there in the beginning, and then it became just sort of a natural thing. Simon was so popular that almost all of his plays automatically got optioned for the screen and generally made and became very successful as movies. I thought, personally, his best screenplay, and the one that should have won him an Oscar, you know, he never won an Oscar. He was nominated 4 times, but never won. He didn't even get an honorary Oscar, which is astounding, considering, you know, what he has contributed. But I loved The Heartbreak Kid in 1972.
Yes. Charles Grodin.
Charles Grodin, Sybil Shepherd, Jeannie Berlin was nominated. Eddie Albert was nominated for that. But Simon wasn't. And that's just a brilliantly structured screenplay. It's from a story by Bruce J. Friedman. But I thought that was one that actually brought him really strong critical acclaim in movies, too. He was taken for granted, I think, by a lot of film critics. His stuff was very commercial, and that doesn't always translate. And what you mentioned before, I thought was really interesting, that they don't give Oscars for comedies often. The only time a Neil Simon movie got nominated for Best Picture was The Goodbye Girl, and that was an original screenplay. And oddly enough, it lost to a comedy that year, Annie Hall.
That's funny. That's very funny. We're talking with Pete Hammond, chief film critic for Deadline, awards columnist as well. John Lahr, who was the senior drama critic for The New Yorker for 2 decades plus, both talking about the legacy of playwright-screenwriter Neil Simon. Natalie in North Hollywood, welcome.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that I'm a journeyman actor. I've been an actor since the 80s. And when I was an undergraduate, Neil Simon was the biggest deal. I believe deeply that he influenced our whole generation of actors. because he was so large in the acting sphere. And so much so that my theater history teacher used to tell us that basically Shakespeare was the Neil Simon of his time. And having studied a lot of Shakespeare, I totally agree with him.
Well, the other thing, Natalie, is that so many young actors come up in school performing in Neil Simon plays, right? I mean, it's this taken on a whole new life in high schools.
Oh, you do scenes from his plays, you do his plays, you know, you just touch on everything. And when you really need something to do that has character plus life, that would be comedy and drama, I argue there's both, you'd pick a Simon play.
Natalie, great to have your experience as an actor for so many years, talking about Neil Simon. Pete Hammond, let me go back to you to talk about the influence on later generations, because Simon's work has been particularly noted for being remade. How many versions of The Odd Couple, in addition to the TV series? There have been women as The Odd Couple. There have been different configurations, updated versions. There was a new Odd Couple TV show. And again, so many of these productions have been performed on school stages.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Simon is gold for drama teachers in high school. First of all, they're great things to play. They're not controversial. They're human stories. So these are things that are never dated, really. I don't think Simon's plays, if you look at them, are terribly dated. He didn't get very political. I mean, it was always an examination of human beings, often at each other's throats, but nevertheless, very humanistic writing. And I, you mentioned The Odd Couple. I mean, there have been three television series. There was an African American version called The New Odd Couple at one point, and you know, female version. Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau went back in 1998, 30 years later, and did a second movie called The Odd Couple 2, which was actually Simon's last screenplay, and it wasn't as acclaimed as the first one. Maybe they waited way too long for Lemmon and Matthau to do that. But he's been so imitated. Actually, that Odd Couple 2 came after the Grumpy Old Men movies that Lemmon and Matthau did, and I think it paled by comparison at that point in their careers. It was interesting. Simon couldn't even, like, you know, follow himself, essentially, with that. His early work is just so, you know, amazing and performed over and over and over again that it was hard to find a second act for him. But I'll tell you, that prime of him that you mentioned from the 60s and the 70s up through the 80s, you know, and when he found his own voice with Brighton Beach Memoirs, the trilogy that he did, and Lost in Yonkers, he started to get acclaim from critics for that, too, because he did drama. He really, you know, people say,
isn't that funny? Yeah,
with comedy or comedy, you know, with drama. But he was able to merge that brilliantly. And Chapter 2, another one about getting into a second marriage with a younger woman.
Hey, Pete, hold your thought, because we're almost out of time. John Laura, I just wanted to ask you real quickly, because you knew Simon later in his life. Did he feel like that he had that critical praise that he maybe felt earlier he hadn't gotten?
Well, I think you're asking me, because I couldn't hear you too well over here. But did the critical plays at the end?
Yeah. Did he feel sort of critically redeemed later in his life?
Well, you know, I have to disagree with Peter, if that's his name, because he was he had hit plays. He got rave reviews. But
I'm so sorry, John. I've got to conclude our conversation. But thank you so much. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going well. Thank you for joining us. Later this hour, we'll talk about night owls and whether the workplace is starting to accommodate people who go to bed later, wake up later, start the workday later. The tech field seems to be one of the places where night owls can find more rest and a better home. We'll talk about that coming up. But first, you know, when I was growing up, the thought was that you would be able to travel from city to city far faster than air travel of the 1960s and 70s provided. Well, in fact, it takes much longer. By the time you deal with traffic and security at the airport, the idea that you could just run down to the airport, jump on a plane, go to San Francisco or Chicago very easily, those days are long gone. We've gone backwards. One of the hopes was that the supersonic transport would enable people to fly intercontinentally much more efficiently and faster. And for a while, we had the Concorde. But that had its own problems, flying between New York and the European continent. But it appears that supersonic air travel may be making a comeback with aircraft that solve some of the problems created by their predecessors. With us is the president and CEO of Spike Aerospace, a Boston-based firm that's developing a low-boom supersonic aircraft, the Spike S-512, Vic Kachortia. Thank you very much, Vic, for joining us.
Larry, thank you for having me on your show. It's great to be here.
So describe for us some of the problems that the Concorde had historically that led it to fall out of favor.
The Concorde, I think, was an incredible aircraft. Keep in mind, it was designed in the 1960s before there were computers and software to help engineers design aircraft. It was designed on draft paper using slide rules. It was designed when gasoline was 25 cents a gallon or less. So after flying for 40 years on old military engines, gasoline was $4 a gallon, and the aircraft had gotten rather old. 40 years is a pretty long time for an aircraft to last. So by that time, $4 a gallon just wasn't going to cut it anymore. On top of that, they didn't have the engineering skills and the computer technology to quieten that boom, to make it more efficient and to make it quieter. And that's what's changed in those 60 years now, to help provide the technology to create low sonic boom and efficient aircraft.
I also remember it's extremely expensive. So you only had very high income people, celebrities who would travel on the Concorde. Was that related almost completely to the fuel price, or was it just they couldn't scale it up enough to make it more affordable through volume?
I think both of those factors come into play. If you think of TVs in the 1990s, flat-screen TVs, they were $25,000. Now they're about $200 for a pretty good-sized screen. It's fantastic how much TV prices have come down, and that was the expectation with the Concorde. Originally, 19 aircraft were built, and that was restricted to fly from New York or Washington to Paris and London. If they had been able to fly over the U.S., New York to L.A., or across Europe and the continents, there would have been significantly more demand, more aircraft, which would have brought the prices down and make it more affordable for everyone. Things have changed a lot in those years.
Yeah, and so briefly explain to us how the Spike S-512, the supersonic aircraft you're developing, how that attempts to solve the noise pollution problem of the sonic boom.
So the Concorde was a 100-passenger aircraft, about 220 feet long, I believe, 600,000 pounds. It's a very heavy, long aircraft. And all of those factors play into the sonic boom. The longer an aircraft is and the heavier it is, that plays into the aircraft noise and how much sonic boom is going to be heard on the ground. Also, the shape of the wing, the design of the wing play into it. So using technology and software that allows us to simulate the aircraft, we are able to optimize the wing, the planform of the aircraft to reduce that sonic boom. In addition, our aircraft is only 18 passengers, significantly shorter and significantly lighter. All of those factors contribute to a much lower sonic boom that when it flies overhead, it should be no more than an air conditioner in the background. You would probably, it'd be hard to notice.
With only 18 passengers, though, it would seem that the cost of taking a flight on that would be huge, right? Because how would you, with the fuel costs, how could that be affordable?
Well, it's not going to be the same price as an economy flight on Delta or United Airlines. Absolutely not. Not initially. Our goal is, as we develop experience, recover R&D costs, we'll be able to bring the cost of the aircraft down. We'll be able to build larger aircraft in the future. But right now, we start with an aircraft that we know there's a demand for. We know people fly first and business class, an awful lot of people. In our analysis, about 110 million people fly business first class in long-range international destinations, and that's what we're looking to do. So we can fill an 18-passenger aircraft. The price will be very similar to what it costs to fly a Gulfstream from L.A. to Tokyo or New York to London on a Gulfstream aircraft. But per seat, it's the same as a business or first-class ticket.
And how much of a time savings are we talking about to fly supersonically versus conventional air travel?
It's going to save about 50% flight time. But in addition to that, you're going to save a lot of time on the ground. As you talked about at the very beginning of this, you have a lot of delays. In addition, you have the TSA on our side. If you're flying internationally, you got to be at the airport 2 hours ahead of time. And on the other end, you got to go through immigration. Executive jets or business jets can fly out of special terminals designed for those smaller aircraft. You don't want a small aircraft flying out of where a 737 flies out of. It just isn't efficient. So they fly out of special terminals. They essentially can just walk on the plane. They don't have to wait 2 hours. And once they get to the other side, they can pretty much walk off. They flash their passport and keep going. So instead of the 3 additional hours, it's cut down to less than half an hour. So you cut your flight times down, and you cut your TSA and immigration downtime, and you've saved 60% time. For instance, Washington, D.C. to L.A. would be 2 hours, and Tokyo would be 5 hours.
And, but if you scale up, of course, you're going to have the same sorts of security issues. I wonder, though, what top speed are you aiming at?
We're aiming at Mach 1.6, which is about 1,100 miles an hour, about 500 miles an hour faster than any other aircraft.
We're talking with the president and CEO of Spike Aerospace based in Boston. They're developing a low-boom supersonic aircraft, the Spike S-512. However, they're not the only company that's doing it. Lockheed also working on developing a supersonic aircraft that could be used for commercial usage. With us, Vic Kachorya of Spike Aerospace. Also with us, airline pilot and author of Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Patrick Smith. Sir, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Do you think that the problems inherent in supersonic air travel can be overcome and that this could be commercially viable?
It could be, but I'm skeptical. And Larry, I want to go back to your intro for a second. I don't know that it's fair to say that we've gone backwards. It is true that airplanes, commercial planes today, fly slightly slower than they did in the 1960s or 1970s, but it's also true that we've got planes going everywhere all the time. Pretty much every two major cities, not just domestically, but globally, are connected now nonstop, and that did not used to be the case. There were times when just flying across the U.S., you made 3 or 4 stops.
That's a very good point. I guess I was thinking, you know, the other night I was flipping the dial and old Perry Mason from the early 60s comes out, and Perry, the attorney, you know, tells his private investigator, we'll just go down to LAX and, you know, jump on a flight to San Francisco. And in those days, you could do that. You could drive to the airport, no ticket, just walk right up, buy your ticket and jump on a plane, and you would be in San Francisco an hour later. You can't do that now.
No, and those are the ancillary inconveniences that we have to factor in to modern-day air travel. It's not just the length of the flight. It's all the before and after logistical hassles. And getting to this concept, you've got development costs, you've got acquisition costs, and you've got operational costs for a supersonic airplane. That's not by any stretch cheap, and I have a feeling fares on such aircraft would be very, very high. And for the consumer, for the passenger, you know, looking at this in a commercial airline context, are people really going to be willing to spend that much more to fly in, say, half the time, especially when you have today's premium class, first and business class cabins as over-the-top luxurious as they are?
And you can work on the trip.
If people want to trade, correct, comfort for time, and then you've got other infrastructural challenges. Your other guest was alluding to building separate terminals and so on, and you brought up the issue of security. How would that factor in? It's not going to be that simple.
So do you think it would be a matter you'd have to have it cost competitive with first-class commercial air travel? If you could get the price point there, do you think people would use it to pick up the speed?
Yeah, I think some people would. Can you break even with those fares with only 18 seats on a modern-day commercial plane? I don't know. You know, meanwhile, though, it's fair to say there probably would be some corporate applications for an airplane like this. So companies and corporations flying executives around on such an aircraft. You know, that to me is more feasible and more probable than the idea of just average passengers doing this on a commercial level.
Well, I'm also thinking of, you know, some of the business people from Asia who come to the U.S. and, you know, are huge buyers of luxury goods and big presence in Las Vegas and, you know, drop, you know, huge amounts of money at a time. For someone like that, where they've got more money than they've got time, I could see where this would be appealing.
I'm sure it would for some people. And this is just me talking. I personally would rather sit in first class on the Singapore Airlines for as long as I possibly could rather than save some time and fly supersonically in a not so luxurious cabin. But
is there a downside for the passenger in a supersonic aircraft at all, to your not in terms of the ride that you get with that, Patrick?
Say that again.
Is there a downside in terms of the ride for air travel on a supersonic a jet going that fast?
With 18 seats on a slightly scaled up corporate sized aircraft, which is what we're talking about, I think your luxurious your amenities are only going to go so far. You're not going to have showers and bars and the sort of thing that we see in a lot of high end premium cabins today on 747s and A380s and so on.
Vic Kachoria, your response to that?
Well, I'm not sure if the pilot has seen pictures of our aircraft. I think our interior will be tremendously luxurious, probably more so than any other corporate jet out there. It can have an air shower if you want that, but you're only flying for 3 hours. Do you really want to have a shower then? Do you need a bed? Do you need a lay flat bed? The seats are going to be incredibly comfortable. The cabin pressure is going to be significantly higher than most airlines. But, you know, he's right. This is not an aircraft for everyone. You are not going to be flying from LA to San Francisco to visit grandma. It's probably not going to work for the average Joe public. I'm sorry, not right now. In the future, we hope that's the case. But it is for corporate clients that need to do operations all over the globe. I fly a lot. I can't make some of my meetings because I just can't get there in time. And there's an awful lot of people like that travel a lot. And that's who it's designed for. It's 18 passengers because we know it's a limited market. But we hope that grows as we bring the cost down.
Vic, what about the fuel consumption of a supersonic aircraft versus conventional jet per passenger consumption and also pollution from, you know, what sort of pollution comparison could you make?
Both of them are absolutely incredibly important considerations. I think advances in technology should not have a negative impact on the environment or the community. I think it's absolutely unacceptable and irresponsible to do that. So Spike has spent a lot of time developing low sonic boom aircraft. We work with engine companies to minimize the fuel burn. They're already more efficient than they were 20 years ago, and they're getting more efficient. We're working on that. It is going to burn more fuel than a conventional aircraft, but the time savings are significant. Their value will appeal to some people. As a pilot suggested, is it really worth it? Well, when the cell phones first came out, it was really just the very wealthy. And who really wanted a cell phone? Why would you spend thousands of dollars a month for a phone? That seems crazy. You just use a landline. Obviously, now everybody does have a cell phone and uses that. Over time, things change and needs change. Prices come down. That's what we're hoping and we
All
expect
right.
a lot.
What about the pilots of the aircraft? Could just a typical commercial pilot fly it, or would you need someone who has specialized military training?
So all planes and pilots are certified for that particular aircraft. A 747 pilot could fly a 737, but they don't. They have to be certified and trained for that aircraft. And the same thing for our aircraft. They would have to be trained on the procedures and on how you fly a supersonic jet, the emergency procedures. They don't have to be a military pilot. To a passenger, this is not going to be any different than flying on a 737. It's going to feel exactly the same or very similar. Not going to feel any sudden rushes or anything.
Patrick Smith, airline pilot, author of Cockpit Confidential. Quick closing thoughts, sir.
Yeah, everything Vic just said I think sounds great. I don't deny that there is a market for this airplane, and the technological challenges sound exciting to me, and it does sound like something that's doable. I just want to emphasize for people that this is going to be a niche product for, you know, high-end corporate flyers and not just the new way that we're all going to be traveling.
All right. All right. Very well. Okay. I guess we're going to have to wait a lot longer, if ever, to receive that sort of fast air travel. Patrick Smith, thank you for being with us. Vic Kachoria of Spike Aerospace, based in Boston, thank you so much. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're here every weekday from 10 to noon. Always a pleasure to serve you with some of the most interesting stories we can find. We'll continue by talking about whether there's more of a place for night owls in today's workplaces than in the past. Back in 1 minute. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I'm one of those people who's naturally a night owl. I live in a family of people that are early risers, that are early birds. So I try and deal with it as best I can. I'm up early, of course, to prepare for the show each day. But I try and make up on weekends as I can. But for many Americans, apparently they're starting to find a place in the workforce where the night owl is more comfortable and hours are able to be accommodated for someone who doesn't go to bed till the very early morning hours, sleeps in until close to midday. And with us is executive editor of CNET News, Roger Cheng, to talk about the trend. Roger, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So give a little sense of the culture of tech and how the later hours are being better accommodated in that sector.
Yeah, you're definitely seeing that on Silicon Valley, right? Particular hacker culture, the idea that folks don't follow that traditional 9-to-5 schedule. They, you know, they wake up much later. They work way late into the night. And as a fellow night owl, I am fully appreciative of this trend and this growing acceptance in folks making their own schedules.
Yeah, there was the thought, of course, that, you know, people who are early risers are generally more ambitious, more successful people. It shows they're go-getters in the world. And people who are night owls are kind of more dismissively thought of as laggards, maybe not as focused, less disciplined. But as we've noted in the programs we've done on sleep science and research, that's not the case. And I wonder in tech if that stereotype of late-night people isn't held.
No, I think that it's definitely a more traditional or old-fashioned way of thinking. The idea of the, you know, early bird getting the worm, that doesn't really hold true, particularly out with tech companies, right? There are folks working all hours of the day. You hear about these hackathons where these coders are up all night working on projects, and really that's kind of, I think that's definitely shifted the dynamic on what we accept in terms of our work schedules. And I know, like, personally, I'm fairly flexible with my reporters. Really, ultimately, it's about getting the job done, right? Regardless of what time you get it done, if you can do the job.
Yeah, some people work better, after 8 o'clock at night. That's when they're most productive.
And I would argue that just in general, when you're working later at night, 8, 9 o'clock. There are fewer distractions. There are fewer emails. There are fewer meetings that draw your attention in all different places. And really, if you're able to focus, I find I get most of my best writing done really, really late at night because I've got my kids asleep. No one's emailing me. No one's calling me. I don't have any meetings. I'm just focused on my work.
Yeah. The advantage, of course, is you work in journalism where it's deadline driven. As long as your writers are reading, meeting the deadline, that's the ultimate goal. But I'd like to hear from listeners, if you are a night owl, how have you accommodated that with work? And do you work in a field or at a business where there are accommodations that are made for the way that you work best and for your sleep habits? If you're someone who, can't get up at 6 or 7 in the morning, you've got to sleep later because you went to bed much later. How does your work accommodate that? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Sometimes referred to as, theater hours, because people who work in the theater, of course, they're performing until 10 o'clock at night or later, having their dinner after that, socializing, so they're not to bed till maybe maybe 2 a.m. And then they can sleep in because they don't have to be in the theater till late in the day. So it works for certain performers like that. But conventional workplaces aren't really built around people who are late to bed, late to rise. That even sounds pejorative, doesn't it? Late to bed, as though they should have been to bed early. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, author of Remote, Office Not Required, David Heinemeier Hansen. Thank you so much, David, for being with us.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
What kind of changes do you see in the workplace accommodating people's hours?
I think the switch to remote work, not having requiring everyone to be in an office, naturally lends itself to also being more flexible about the hours. If you're already not that particular about where people work from, you tend also to not be so particular about when they work, because you've switched your whole focus on what kind of work is happening and are you putting people in the best position to do their best possible work. And as you mentioned, there are many people who are simply more productive at night because that's just their natural rhythm. And why wouldn't a business want to accommodate that and get the peak performance from their employees, making them happier in the process? You mentioned the problem with if you go to bed late and then you're still expected to be at the office early, you're simply not going to get enough sleep. And there's plenty of science out on the facts of what happens when you don't get enough sleep. You're going to be more cranky. You're going to be less creative. You're simply going to be a worse worker. So if we allow people to work remote, we might as well also allow them to work when they want to work and simply just ensure that you have a bit of overlap. One of the reasons that a lot of people like working at night is exactly because there are fewer interruptions. They don't get things done at work because work has become an interruption factory, and those are simply not productive hours anymore. So simply offsetting the workforce in such a way that some people work late at night and some people work early in the morning gives more people more time where they have to deal with fewer interruptions. And as long as you just ensure that there's a handful of hours during the day where people do overlap, you will have plenty of time to do those meetings that people seem to think are so important.
Let's talk with Jody in Claremont. Jody, I understand you're a night owl. So how have you worked this into your life?
Well, long before the tech revolution, right, when it was pretty much find an industry that accommodates your lifestyle, I got into the restaurant business and the bar business. And I've been doing that now going on 30 years. And it was like, oh, thank God, something that accommodates my high school was torture for me. I was up till 2 or 3 in the morning reading because I was at my most alert and awake, and then I had to get up at 6:30, and it was just, I think that typical industries have always accommodated morning people, and so that's why we all got a bad rap, because we're dragging ourselves out of bed after only a few hours sleep, and we take till noon to become alert and active and productive. And there, half your day is gone, and you're being looked on as like, "What's wrong with you? You know, wake up!"
Yeah, as though it's a moral failure. Jody, the challenge, of course, for people that work at night like yourself is if you have kids, for example, that can be very difficult. Or if you have a spouse or partner who has a very different schedule, having time with that person, has that been a challenge for you?
It has, you know, and quite honestly, it ended up being the fact that I didn't have kids. You know, it just, everybody has a different path, you know, and some people have to train themselves to become a morning person for that reason. For me, it just became, I value my sleep and my life, and I have 4 beautiful shoes that I can borrow. But yes, that my brother is the same way as me, and he's had to train himself to be a morning person, and the poor guy looks exhausted all the time.
It's not easy. Jody, I really appreciate you sharing your experience. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Ernesto in Westwood, how do you cope with being a night owl at work?
So recently, I just started working as a data analysis scientist, and it's been different because usually I do an 8 to 5 working as a scientist doing experiments. But now that I have the night time to like work, I spend the day kind of pondering over my questions, and then I would go in and attack it at night.
And so that suits your sleep schedule better. Are there any drawbacks to now doing your research at night?
basically, the only thing is I don't have as much of a strict schedule, which I feel like was very helpful from having an 8-to-5. I know when I'll be at work, when I'll be doing the experiment, when I'll be doing that. So I think the only drawback is I feel like I have a very loose schedule, and sometimes it's not very productive.
David Heinemeier Hansen, is that something similarly for people who work remotely and don't go into an office, that for those that you know feel they need a structure, they have to establish that themselves?
That is definitely one of the pitfalls. It's kind of ironic that most bosses fear allowing their workers to work remotely because, oh, what if they goof off all day? Or what if they sit on the couch and play PlayStation or don't do the actual work? Well, first of all, I think it's a great misnomer to think that people can't goof off just because they're in an office. Millions of people do that for most hours every day. But I think the bigger issue is actually talking to workers about ensuring that they have a healthy pattern that doesn't lead to overwork. That has been our number one challenge at Basecamp, to ensure that people don't end up working 10, 12 hours a day just because the whole thing blends together. And we've had all sorts of funny techniques that people at Basecamp have used. One worker, for example, he has two pairs of slippers. He has his work slippers and he has his home slippers. And he makes a conscious effort of changing into his work slippers when he goes into his bedroom office to work. And that helps sort of split the time and make it clear when it's work and when it's not. And I think having a dedicated space for it helps as well. If you just end up sitting on your laptop in your kitchen or on your couch doing your work, well, when does that end and when does that begin? You have to enforce those boundaries and make sure you don't end up overworking.
Jack in Zurich, who's a frequent poster on Air Talk, always with interesting comments, says, I'm working right now, except for posting on KPCC. I usually work in the evenings. He said it's 8:33 there now. Jack in Zurich, posting on the page. Jack, glad to keep you company as you work there. 866-893-KPCC. Bernard in Santa Clarita, you're a night owl, so how have you built your job around that?
Hi there. I happen to be a limo driver, and I thankfully have been accommodated by my work. I work for a local limo company, and I'm a limo driver. And going on 10 years now, it makes it much, much easier for me to work, you know, early afternoon into the late evening wee hours, because I've always been that way. Even as a child, I always had trouble getting up in the morning for school. And now that I'm older, I'm 53, I'm thankful that there's companies and people that are willing to work with night owls. In fact, there's a group of us, we all sort of laugh about it because we don't like getting up in the morning, and I'm fully accommodated, and I'm definitely grateful for it.
Well, and Bernard, I bet there are a lot of people who are professional drivers like you who are attracted to that just because of what you're saying, because prime time so often is in the evening hours, whether you're driving a limo like you or for Uber or Lyft or a taxi, makes a lot of sense, just like the restaurant business. Carlos, by the way, in Van Nuys says, I'm a night owl, work in the restaurant industry. The only drawback, says, by the time I get off work, all the food places are closed. Only fast food is available. Yeah, Carlos, just I guess 24-hour drive-through is pretty much it. I want to thank our guests, Roger Chang of CNET News, where he's executive editor, and David Heinemeier Hansen, who's author of Remote Office Not Required, talking about how night owls are being somewhat better accommodated in the workplace, although certainly a long way to go. The norm still up early, up and at 'em, and at the office at an early hour. Coming up, we have much more conversation, including the overuse of punctuation marks in texts and tweets. What? All those exclamation points? Question marks? We'll continue right after a live update from Eddie Lynn Herdes. This argument between Elaine and her boyfriend Jake on an episode of Seinfeld gets at our issue for this segment of Air Talk.
If one of your close friends had a baby and I left you a message about it, I would use an exclamation point.
Well, maybe I don't use my exclamation points as haphazardly as you do.
You don't think that someone having a baby warrants an exclamation point.
Hey, look, I just jotted down the message. I didn't know that I was required to capture the mood of each caller.
I just thought that you'd be a little more excited about a friend of mine having a baby.
Okay, I'm excited. I just don't happen to like exclamation points.
Well, you know, Jake, you should learn to use them. Like the way I'm talking right now, I will put exclamation points at the ends of all of these sentences. On this one and on that one.
From Seinfeld, the exclamation point. But that's not alone. What's with the multiple question marks? What does that mean? I'd like to hear from you about the use and overuse of punctuation in texts and in tweets. Does it really convey greater meaning? Is the emotion clearer or an attempt at humor clearer as a result of using multiple exclamation points or using them at all? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. With us is Gretchen McCulloch, who is a linguist who studies the language of the Internet. Gretchen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So have we seen a kind of punctuation inflation in social media and texting?
I think we have to some respect, because if you look back to the 1990s in the earlier Internet days, people were also using a lot of exclamation points there. And then we kind of stopped using them as much in the 2000s, and now we seem to be back on this multiple exclamation point cycle.
And I guess the question is, do we hear it differently? My wife last night got a text from a colleague of hers, and it had multiple question mark, multiple exclamation. I said, when she showed me, I said, "So what does this mean?" And my wife gave this perfect reading of exactly what her friend, coworker was communicating in that. And so for her, the multiple translated it very differently. Do you think that it is an efficient way to communicate, or that it's being overused?
I think it's a very efficient way of communicating. One of the big problems that people run into on the internet is that you don't have the ability to have the tone of voice. You can't see people's gestures. And so we know these are an important part of communication when we're talking out loud. Why wouldn't they be important in writing? And what more efficient way of doing that than using the symbols that are already on our keyboards?
Also with us is Deborah Tannen, professor of linguistics at Georgetown University in D.C. And her latest book being released today in paperback, You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships. Deborah Tannen, welcome back to Air Talk.
Pleasure. It's always a pleasure.
So what are your thoughts about how we communicate using punctuation? And do you think that we've got some lack of clarity or problems with how we use those points?
I agreed with everything Gretchen said, and I reacted to your opening comments. One person's use is another person's overuse. And we're dealing here with differences in age and also differences in gender. So women do tend to use exclamation points more, much as in speaking. Our intonation tends to go up and down somewhat more. Women are seen as more expressive. In my book, You Just Don't Understand, I coined the terms rapport talk versus report talk. In that Seinfeld episode, he was saying, "Well, I just took the message." And she was saying, "Yeah, but you should have some feeling about my friend having a baby." So I think it's just a new instantiation of very old patterns. And it often makes me sad that people are so quick to criticize other people's habits of communication. If everybody's doing it, it must be serving a purpose. Clearly, it's working for many people who are using it. So I agree with Gretchen. I think they're great.
I don't use emojis. I use an exclamation point sometimes, single point, if I'm trying to emphasize, or if I'm making a point, it's sort of tongue-in-cheek what I'm putting into writing, so it won't be taken seriously. Because ironically, the exclamation point, while it can say enthusiasm, it can also, in that enthusiasm, convey, Gretchen McCulloch, that it is a humorous observation.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, misreading sarcasm is a huge problem. Exclamation marks or emoji or various other types of resources can solve that.
Let's talk with Ben in Santa Ana. You're on Air Talk.
Yes, I am a 42-year-old professional photographer who recently went back to community college to take some classes. And one of the things I discovered immediately, because I started texting the kids to find out things about the class, was that in an age group between, I don't know, I guess maybe 17 to 22 or 3, they find any form of punctuation to be insulting and somewhat aggressive.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. No, in a period. We're not talking about exclamation marks, question marks, or any of the, or ellipses, or any of
a
the
period other. At the end of a sentence.
Yes, so that means that the person sending the text is actually angry at you because they and capitalization as well. And now I thought this was absurd, but then I turned around to the other part of the class. I asked, and all of them, all 20 of them, started nodding their heads. So I think this is something that people in our age groups aren't aware of. So next time you're texting someone young, just be careful not to make them angry with that period.
Gosh, yeah, I guess they'll have to confront me with it. I think one of the challenges for those of us that are older, if you take out the punctuation, it takes a little longer to navigate through the thought and to understand where the grouping is, particularly if there are multiple concepts in a text. So if your students text you or write you an email, is it sometimes take a little longer for you to decipher it, Ben, without the punctuation?
Well, the emails seem to be punctuation friendly. The texts do not seem to be punctuation friendly. But what I think is funny is I'm of a generation where if I spell something wrong in a text and it's obvious that I spelled something wrong, like not adding an extra O to a 2, right, or something like that, I will go out of my way to make sure that person knows that I know how to spell that, just because I'm afraid that I might be insulting them.
Ben, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Deborah Tannen, your thoughts on punctuation aggression.
Yes, absolutely. And I wonder, it's such a good point about the difference in the generations. When I talk about this, older people are stunned that younger people take the period as a sign of anger. And three dots, which to older people means, yeah, more and more. To younger people,
yeah.
I don't mean what I just said. So I love you, dot, 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 means I don't really love you. I think this impression of aggression can come, it goes back to my observation about use and overuse. If you expect it, it's not going to come across that way. If you don't, then capitalization sounds like shouting. Repetition of letters, words, punctuation marks can sound like aggression. But I don't think it does as a rule for people who are used to using it that way.
Gretchen McCullough, you're a linguist. How do you think this evolved, that punctuation was seen as hostile?
One of the things that I think is really interesting is that in language, a lot of people have this baggage about being told how to write, or being told how to talk, being told what's correct. And so I see the deliberate lack of use of punctuation, the deliberate lack of use of capitalization, things like that, as a way of kind of, it's like telling a self-deprecating joke. If you already are using lack of capitalization, lack of punctuation, that's a friendly move. That's saying, I can't be this sanctimonious person criticizing your language because I'm already putting myself in a position where other people could criticize me. And so if you're both doing that, you're both in this stage where you're giving something or you're giving up something in a way that seems to look friendly. Whereas if you try to use standard capitalization and punctuation in an informal context, like a text message, that makes it look like you're trying to put yourself up on a high horse to be able to criticize someone. So I think that's where some of the hostility impression can come from people who are interpreting messages that way.
That's fascinating. So it the root you're describing is a fear of judgment. They're afraid of being judged.
A preemptive move to decide not to judge, to say we're
but
both
it's really
going to
about,
be in the situation.
But it's really about not being judged oneself.
It's both. It's deciding not to judge others and deciding not to judge oneself.
But it only becomes I was going to say, because it only becomes about not judging others, as it would only be in that context if it was out of fear of one being judged. The one would have to come from the other.
I think it's that fear response that I hear from older people who are talking about, well, I always use correct capitalization and punctuation because that's what I was taught in school. And so having that sense of superiority and that sense of like, well, I feel entitled to judge about these types of things is that can be this kind of this feeling of hostility or sanctimoniousness that can come across in text messages. If you're making a point of always using very correct things, it makes you sound like you're obsessed with being correct and like you're going to judge other people.
Yeah, it's just I think the challenge is for someone who's older, you don't want to just be reactive because other people are doing it. But I'd love to hear from listeners your thoughts about this. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. The use of punctuation marks and specifically the exclamation point, using multiple question marks, does that convey greater clarity? Does that help you to hear the person, understand the person who's communicating via text or if they're tweeting or posting somewhere? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about uppercase versus lowercase punctuation marks, how those all play out in texts, online communication, tweets, and the like. So I'd like to hear from you. I'm curious if you have changed as a result of peer pressure, how other people are perceiving the way in which you communicate. Has it led you to reduce the number of exclamation points or question marks, to drop capitals because of fear of being judged by others? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Erica in Newport Beach, welcome.
Hi, I'm a millennial. I'm 22 years old, and I just wanted to comment that punctuation has also become for us part of meme culture, that for many of us, we include, for instance, a space after what we've said and then two exclamation points, and that that has very specific meaning for the kind of meme or inside joke that you're making, which would be different entirely from using two exclamation points right after the sentence or just one exclamation point.
Can you, would it take too much time to describe what that difference is?
Well, I'd have to, let's see if I can think of a concrete example. It's sort of an emphasis that indicates a level of skepticism about what's being said, I would say, if you have
okay.
a space and then two exclamation points.
Interest. So it's like the beat of like a thought beat to sort of like say what is and then the exclamation point.
Right. Correct.
Okay. Okay.
You have the same thing with two question marks. That would be both. That would include an element of anger.
So the double question marks would be anger.
After a space.
After a space. Okay. Oh, wow. How do you learn all this, Erica?
It's like how I learn what voice tones mean in terms of people's emotion.
Okay, yeah.
Growing up, socialization.
All right, very good. All right, thanks so much. I appreciate it. That's Erica in Newport Beach. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Gretchen McCulloch, a linguist, can you elaborate a bit more about the evolution? Because one of the differences is, you know, unlike the vocal tone, that we learn over time from when we're very young. These sorts of, you know, usage of letters and punctuation marks and spaces have been learned over a comparatively shorter period.
Well, writing itself is something that is, you know, an artificial thing that's learned in a more formal way than speech. And if you look at the history of writing, the Romans, the Greeks, they didn't write with spaces or a difference between capitals and lowercase or any sort of punctuation at all. They wrote like a crossword puzzle, you know, word search, just a grid. And you had to figure out where the words began and end and where the sentences began and ended and all of these types of things. And it was later, you know, medieval scribes started introducing punctuation marks and spaces between words and things like that. And so I think it's really interesting to see the next stage of evolution of punctuation, not just indicating grammatical categories, but also indicating things like tone of voice.
All right. Deborah Tannen, your thoughts on this and the rapidity in which it evolves.
Yes, yes. I would absolutely observe that the rapidity with which change is happening has been pretty striking. And when my students talk about their interactions with their even 2 years younger siblings, they feel that they're using these all these markers in very different ways. So what makes a generation is actually very small because things are changing so fast. And I think it also introduces a little bit of insecurity for everybody because you're not sure that what you're doing is going to be right to the person that you're talking to, especially with email. And I think students definitely regard email as a formal medium, whereas for us older people, we still think of email as rather informal. And so I think many of us simply try to look back on the message that we received and maybe do the same thing. So go back and see how many exclamation points that person used, and so maybe you'll add one or take one away.
Yeah.
Based on that. But this absolutely is how communication has worked all along. We develop new habits, and we pick them up from the people that we communicate with.
Well, and the other, we're really getting at, you know, the what underlies this is it is a more limited form of communication than voice. And so when you limit and you only have letters and characters, the text to be able to communicate, it's much more difficult to convey nuance. A voice is able to do that much more. When you're standing face-to-face with someone, it adds yet the additional body language, facial expressions and the like. So you know, the more you limit it, such as in a text, the more difficult it is to communicate. And what's odd is that it then sort of forces you to talk to the person or to use more text to clarify what the underlying intent is. So it just adds layers of complexity. Carlos in Van Nuys says, I'm a millennial. I think that the more punctuation someone uses consistently, the less impact it has. So when someone doesn't use punctuation often, any punctuation comes off as serious or aggressive. Carlos, very good point. And Janaea tweets at AirTalk, as a college professor who teaches English, I appreciate the fluency of language required to code switch from standard English to text speak. Janaea, thank you so much. My thanks to our guest, Deborah Tannen. Her latest book, You're the Only One I Can Tell, Inside the Language of Women's Friendships, just out today in paperback. She's professor of linguistics, Georgetown University, and Gretchen McCulloch, also a linguist, hosts the podcast Lingthusiasm. From all of us at AirTalk, have a wonderful afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next.